Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. In March of 1969, less than 3 months after the triumphant flight of Apollo 8, which circled the moon at Christmas of 1968, three astronauts once again climbed aboard a Saturn V rocket. But this time, the target wasn't the moon. It was Earth orbit, which may seem kind of anticlimactic. But the mission was an ambitious one that was a pivotal next step as NASA tried to reach the late President Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth by the end of the decade. Apollo 9 was a test pilot's dream mission with a host of firsts: the first flight of the lunar module in space, the first rendezvous and docking between the two Apollo spacecraft, the command and service module with the lunar lander that would carry the two astronauts down to the moon's surface while one astronaut remained in orbit, the first test of the new Apollo spacesuit that would be donned by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the surface of the moon just a few months later in July, if all went well. And that was a big if, and on Apollo 9, as we will find out from our guest, not everything went well. Rusty Schweikert was a rookie astronaut who was the lunar module pilot for the mission and the one who had to test the suit in the vacuum of space. But a bout of space sickness nearly canceled that test and could have severely hampered the mission from reaching its ambitious objectives. It would turn out to be Schweikert's only test flight, but he went on to play an important role in the Astronaut Corps and later helped found the B612 Foundation dedicated to protecting Earth from the threat of asteroid impact. Schweikert is also in charge of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 9 mission celebration at the San Diego Air and Space Museum, along with his crewmates Commander Jim McDivitt and Command Module Pilot Dave Scott. Schweikert joined us from his home in the Bay Area. Rusty Schweikert, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
Well, I see that you have a big, before we get going into the mission and stuff, you've got a big get-together coming up in San Diego, right?
Right. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of our Apollo 9 flight on Splashdown Day, the 13th of March, at the San Diego Air and Space Museum.
And what kind of guests are you expecting there? Is the whole crew going to be there?
Well, the whole crew is going to be there. We're one of the two crews with everybody still kicking around. So the three of us will be there, plus personal guests and friends and people who work with us in the space program. It's actually open to everybody, I think.
Wow, sounds like fun. And like you said, your crew, the Apollo 9 crew and the Apollo 8 crew, are the only crews right now where, you know, everybody's still, as you put it, kicking around.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a little shocking, frankly, on a personal note, but
yeah,
life is what it is.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, let's start out. I'd like to get a little profile of your crewmates. So let's start out with you. Briefly, you know, tell us about your journey from being a fighter pilot to becoming an astronaut.
Well, right after I graduated from MIT in 1956, I had been in ROTC and therefore went directly into the Air Force, as a second lieutenant, and elected to be a fighter pilot, which had been, frankly, an ambition all my life. And so I went through pilot training in the Air Force, various bases and things, and then ended up in an operational F-100 squadron over in the Philippine Islands. And after about 4 years, my term, my obligation was up, and I applied to and got back into MIT graduate school and went back to Cambridge, Mass. In what had become, from aeronautical engineering, it had morphed into aeronautics and astronautics. And so I got back there in 1960 and joined the Aero and Astro Department, both in the form of teaching assistant, but also working in one of the labs there and studying and raising a family and flying in the Air National Guard. It was a
Wow.
pretty busy time, actually.
And you were part of the third astronaut class, 1963, is that right?
Yeah, there were a few years in there. During my graduate work at MIT, while I was flying, as I said, with the Air Guard, on weekends and to make a little extra money and to keep up my flying, the Berlin Wall went up, and I got called back onto active duty by President John Kennedy, who activated the Mass Air Guard, along with a number of other reserve outfits, and deployed over to eastern France for a year, and got back to MIT a year later, finished up my my master's degree in aero and astro, and at the same time, NASA was looking for a new group of astronauts, and I had been trying to figure out from an episode we might want to talk about that I had over in Europe when I was flying with the guard over there. But I had decided I wanted to become an astronaut. And so a number of us at MIT were kind of looking at, do you have to be a test pilot? And if so, how do I get to be a test pilot and all that kind of thing? And it turned out that NASA changed the application requirements. And you could either be a test pilot in the third group that was selected, or you could have an advanced degree and at least 1,000 hours of high-performance jet time. And I qualified for the application under that latter group.
Well, and then you get selected to a crew with Jim McDivitt and Dave Scott. And you guys were the backup crew for Apollo 1, the crew that perished in the fire in 1967, right?
That's right. Yeah, we first, I was selected in 63 and did a lot of things in the astronaut office first, but then when I was selected for a crew, as you say, it was our McDivitt, Scott, Schweikart crew, and we first backed up, Grissom, White, and Chaffee on the first Apollo mission. We actually shifted off that mission as their backup about 2 months, I think it was, before the fire occurred on the pad that wiped those guys out. But when that actually happened, we had already shifted over to the first lunar module flight.
Could you just give us a brief thumbnail sketch about your crewmates? Let's start out with the commander. Tell us just a bit about Jim McDivitt.
Yeah, they're both great guys. Jim and Dave. Dave came in the program at the same time I did in the third group, but Jim was in the second group of people who were selected, second group of astronauts. Jim was just I don't know what to call him other than a great guy. He was very personable, University of Michigan. He was had a great sense of humor. And frankly, he was a very good leader. I got to know Jim first when I helped out on his earlier mission, which was Gemini 4. He and Ed White, Jim was a commander, and Ed was the pilot on the Gemini 4 mission. And I was a brand new astronaut at that time, and I got a chance to play a very small role during the launch of Gemini 4, but we spent a lot of time down at the Cape together, and in fact, kind of as a personal aside, I can remember at the time we had gotten the word that the Soviets were going to be doing an extravehicular activity during one of their upcoming missions, and so the Gemini 4 flight basically assigned Ed White to do an EVA on the Gemini 4 flight. And we had put together a little handgun that you may remember that they flew, and we were kind of crashing, getting everything ready and getting off the ground. And we were sitting down at the Cape watching television one night, and there on the news came, that Alexei Leonov had already done an EVA that day. I mean, so it was... it was a historic time in the space program and the big competition with the Soviet Union.
Any EVA for our non-space techie type people, extravehicular activity, spacewalk. That was the first American spacewalk, Ed White, on Gemini 4.
Right, and Jim McDivitt was a commander, and people who are old enough will probably remember the sort of phony story. It was, there was some truth in it, but the kind of phony story that Ed White didn't want to come back in after he went outside on the EVA, and Jim had to order him back inside the spacecraft. I mean, it was all in good fun, but Ed was having a good time out there on the first EVA that we'd done in the U.S. program. And when you get outside, it's a beautiful experience. And you are very reluctant when the time is up and you got to get back in.
I even remember a song that was on the radio about him. Ed White, what a sight he saw, what a brave and lucky guy.
Well, I'm glad you sang it, not me. You know, it does capture a bit of the experience.
Yeah, it was one of those 60s types songs that you caught on the radio, but I remember that. And then tell us a bit about Dave Scott. He also commanded Apollo 15.
Yeah, Dave was a Academy graduate, military West Point Academy graduate, and Dave is a bit, let me say, more formal, a bit stiffer than Jim, he was a command module pilot on our mission. And Dave kind of sees, Apollo 9 as, hey, that was the lunar module. I played a very small role in it. He's playing, it's very modest. But on the other hand, I think it's probably because Dave became the commander on Apollo 15. And that was a lot more impressive memory and responsibility for him than Apollo 9, where in some sense, as he says, the primary purpose of Apollo 9 was really testing the lunar module. On Apollo 15, he commanded, the lunar module to a landing at Hadley Rill on the moon. I mean, it was an extremely exciting mission. So, I can hardly blame Dave for seeing himself tied a bit more to Apollo 15 than to Apollo 9.
Sure, and the fact that he was a commander. Well, one of my experiences the last few months, especially when I talk to people about these 50th anniversaries of the flights of Apollo, with 9 coming up here in March 3rd to the 13th, is they really don't understand very much at all about the mission profile of how we actually got to the moon. There's kind of just this amorphous thought in their head, like, oh, there's space shuttle. Is it a space shuttle? What's Apollo? They don't really know. And I'm talking about, older, pretty educated people. So what I'd like to have you do is go through a real simple primer with us. Tell us first about how we actually got to the moon and this idea of lunar orbit rendezvous.
Yeah, that's an interesting history. Getting to the moon requires some very clever engineering. And, of course, back in the early 60s, late 50s, even early 60s, when people started looking at or thinking seriously of going to the moon, that's a really daunting challenge. The biggest problem being that to get something down on the surface of the moon, because the moon has, substantial gravity, about 1/6 of what Earth's gravity is, you still got to carry a whole bunch of fuel and slow down with a rocket engine in order to land on the moon. Well, that means you got to carry not just a lunar module and everything else with people and stuff, but you've got to carry the fuel that you need to get you down there. And then, of course, to get up off the moon, you got to have fuel to do that too. So you're carrying a whole bunch of fuel all the way to the moon. When all of that takes a lot of lifting power, a lot of oomph to get off. If you take it all the way back to what you've got to launch off the Earth in order to get out to the moon, down to the moon, up off the moon, and accelerating back to the Earth, you end up with a humongous vehicle. I mean, one much larger than we could possibly build. So one of the things you're looking for is how can you minimize all of that mass that you've got to lift off the ground. And there were a couple of major options that were looked at, and in fact, one that was looked at with some favor was to launch a couple of vehicles into orbit around the Earth and get them together, by launching two vehicles off the Earth and then joining them in Earth rendezvous. You could then take a combined vehicle out to the moon. That was one way you could carry a bunch of stuff. But then toward the end of a lot of the discussion, the early discussions, the idea of what was called lunar orbit rendezvous rather than Earth orbit rendezvous, and that really allowed us to go to the moon with just a single launch from the Earth, but then in lunar orbit to break the spacecraft into two pieces, one of which would stay in orbit around the moon and just send a smaller landing craft down to the surface of the moon. That was pretty tricky because then you had to get up off the moon and re-rendezvous with your heat shield, which was in orbit around the moon, and then take that vehicle back to the Earth. But overall, that was a smaller launch vehicle off the Earth. And therefore, even though the Saturn V, which was required to do that job, was the biggest launch vehicle ever built, it was a good bit smaller than an Earth orbit rendezvous design would have required.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our conversation with Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Schweikert as we look back at the 50th anniversary of that mission in March of 1969. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with astronaut Rusty Schweikert as we look back at the Apollo 9 mission from March 1969, 50 years ago. Let's go to Apollo 9, which happens just a few months after the epic voyage to the moon of Apollo 8. And that one gets celebrated in the history books and documentaries and gets a lot of attention for the magnificent Earthrise photograph that William Anders took, and rightfully so. But Apollo 9, to me, is such an amazing mission because it's like a test pilot's dream. There are so many engineering goals that have to be met, so many things that you have to do, that the Apollo 8 mission, by comparison, actually is really pretty simple. You know, they just took one vehicle, flew around the moon. It was bold and daring and all that. But your mission had just so much more complexity to it. So I'd like to, before we get to all the things that happen, could you take us to launch day and describe for us from bottom to top what that fully loaded Saturn V rocket was like? Because, again, a lot of our listeners really aren't familiar with the hardware. So take us through that massive rocket and what's inside of it, where the lunar module is, for example, and then, you know, where you are sitting atop it.
The Saturn V was comprised of three stages. The whole thing weighed 6 million pounds, a lot of aluminum and a heck of a lot of fuel. Almost all of that, 90% or so of that 6 million pounds was fuel. And the first stage got the whole works off the ground. A couple minutes after you got off the ground, you would have burned, I don't know how many, probably 4 million pounds of fuel in 2 minutes, and separate with the second stage. A second stage had a big engine on it, but used liquid oxygen and liquid oxidizer, liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. And the second stage with the J2 engine was much lower acceleration, but it lasted longer and would get us up close to being in orbit. And then we'd launch the third, light third stage to get into orbit. But on our mission, we didn't have to go beyond that. So the third stage really was not exactly redundant, but that was a part that on later missions got you to the moon. That was the one that took you out of Earth orbit and sent you on the way to the moon. It's hard to describe in words. I mean, people who are interested should take a look at the pictures because, you know, there's so many pieces and things that had to happen there that it's a little hard to describe it in words to someone who's not used to looking at it.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than the basic what a space shuttle looks like, even though that was a very complex machine. And so now you're in orbit. You've turned around and extracted the LEM. And for the first time, we have names for our two vehicles in space. Gumdrop is the command module. And I love the name of the lunar module, Spider. So and let's talk about what the goals are, because there's so many engineering goals in this mission. Could you give us, like, what are some of the things you guys were tasked with accomplishing in orbit?
Well, you know, the first thing, Dave, is to recognize that we had, as I said, we had two real spacecraft there. Basically, the two spacecraft were the lunar module. But the lunar module itself had an ascent stage and a descent stage. The ascent stage got us off the moon. The whole thing, the ascent and descent stage together, had to go down to the moon. But then we used the descent stage as a launching platform, and we just launched the ascent stage to get us back up into orbit and rendezvous with the command module. So the lunar module itself had two stages to it, two parts. And each of those parts had a big rocket engine, the descent stage, to get you down to the moon and land safely using a throttleable engine, a throttleable rocket engine, one of the first ones. And then the ascent stage had the ascent engine buried in the middle of it, and that got you back up off the moon. The command module was a little conical-shaped thing, a gumdrop, as I said, that would bring you home. Hooked onto the back of it was a service module, which had all kinds of supplies and fuel and everything else, and a huge rocket engine on the back so that you could actually accelerate back to the Earth after the guys from the moon came back up. On the Apollo 9 mission, we had to test all of these different combinations and permutations of these various spacecraft and make sure that all of that worked. So that was one of the major things that we had to do on Apollo 9. But in addition to that, then we were flying for the first time the new Apollo spacesuit, the A7L. We've had a lot of problems on Gemini with the extravehicular spacesuit, you know, the one where you go outside and start doing things. And I was the first guy that got the chance to test that new Apollo suit, which not only had to do, you know, to work in zero G and weightlessness as on Apollo 9, but my friends all had to run around on the moon with it. And so, you know, you were literally running around in the suit. It had to really work and be easy and flexible so that the guys weren't totally exhausted after, you know, an hour or so. So, and of course, you couldn't drag an umbilical all the way from the lunar module out across the moon for a couple miles. You had to have a backpack on that Apollo suit so that the guys were independent of the spacecraft And, of course, you couldn't drag an umbilical all the way from the lunar module out across the moon for a couple miles. You had to have a backpack on that Apollo suit so that the guys were independent of the spacecraft. And up until Apollo 9, we had never flown a mission where we had only a tether to the EVA astronaut rather than a big, heavy, thick umbilical, which provided all of the life support as well as just, you know, keeping you from drifting away. So that was all new. And then in addition to that, the descent engine of the lunar module had to work and the throttling had to work. It had to be controllable. And most important, we had to prove that we could get back to the command service module once you got into orbit around the moon. So we had to do a rendezvous. And so this was, as you said, a big engineering test flight. It was probably the most ambitious first flight of any complex aerospace vehicle.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rusty Schweikert, the lunar module pilot for the Apollo 9 test flight in Earth orbit in March of 1969. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's hear more now of our interview with astronaut Rusty Schweikert as we look back at the Apollo 9 mission. Along with his commander Jim McDivitt and command module pilot Dave Scott, Schweikert was part of the first all-up test of the two Apollo spacecraft, the command service module and lunar module, that would attempt a lunar landing just 4 months later in July of 1969 with Apollo 11. Throwing a monkey wrench in all of this stuff was, you know, right after you get into orbit. And I know you know what's coming up is, I hate to use that expression, coming up, but you get sick and you're one of the first cases of space sickness. And it turns out that about 50% of all astronauts that go into orbit, you know, suffer from this in the first few days. So but at that time, nobody really knew what this was. Could you tell us a bit about what it was like to go through that and how that almost prevented your mission from being able to accomplish all these things?
Yeah, well, that's a heck of a story, Dave. Actually, I was certainly not the first guy that got sick in spaceflight. We had heard that one or two of the Russians had a problem. We didn't know much about it. There wasn't that much communication between the Soviet and the U.S. program at the time, but we had heard about that. And then on Apollo 8, Frank Borman had gotten sick, but Frank was a little bit of a macho guy and wasn't terribly interested in acknowledging it at first, and he didn't want to do any tests about it. And so on Apollo 9, I knew I was somewhat susceptible to motion sickness, but it wasn't so clear that there was a real correlation with, let's say, seasickness and space sickness at the time. We didn't really know much about it. But let me just say, when I launched, I knew Frank had gotten sick, but Frank refused to take any post-flight tests, so we didn't learn anything from Frank barfing, unfortunately. By the way, I've never forgiven him for that. But but, you know, knowing that I was somewhat susceptible to seasickness, never got me car sick or anything, but I knew I was susceptible to motion sickness. And so we also knew, one of the few things that we knew was that if you didn't move your head around as much, or let me say, if you did move your head around a lot, you were going to bring it on. You were going to aggravate the sensitivity. So, you know, using logic, I simply avoided for the first couple days of the mission, where I didn't have all that much to do. I could remain relatively motion free. So I kept my head still, figuring, okay, great, I'm just going to adapt here. First couple days before I have to really get with it on the third day of the mission. I had to go over into the lunar module to check out all the systems and that kind of thing. And then the fourth day of the mission was going to be my EVA, and the fifth day of the mission was going to be the rendezvous, you know, docking and all of that. So my real work started on the third day, so I kind of cooled it the first couple of days and didn't move around a lot. Lo and behold, what we found out afterward, when I became volunteer after the mission to become a guinea pig for motion sickness so we could learn something about it, we found out that all I did on the mission was aggravate the situation, in that we realized that you only adapt as you do move around in the unusual environment, in this case, weightlessness. And let me just say something about motion sickness. You know, whether you're talking about seasickness or car sickness or space sickness, motion sickness is motion sickness, and we don't really understand a lot about the evolutionary need for motion sickness, for barfing as a result of unusual motion. But what we do know is that the end result is the same. I mean, you vomit. I mean, that's the evolutionary thing that you do when you've got when you get motion sick, regardless of what the nature of the motion is. In the case of weightlessness, it's the fact that, you know, these two things that you normally have connected walking around on Earth in a gravity field become disconnected. Rotation in space is still rotation, and you rotate your head and your semicircular canal say, I'm moving my head this way or that way. But on Earth, as you move your head, you don't think about it, but as you move your head, for example, if you look down at your feet, the gravity vector inside your head has moved. That is, you look down at your feet, and your nose is down. You look up at the horizon, and your nose is straight ahead. So the gravity is changing in your inner ear at the same time, and because you rotated your head. But in weightlessness, you rotate your head, look at your feet, there is no gravity vector. You're in weightlessness, so you don't even feel gravity. You're not feeling that acceleration. Well, your brain doesn't quite know what to do with that. It says, hey, something weird is going on here. You know, the end result of something weird going on is I'm going to make this guy barf. Or if he's susceptible, that is, right? So that's what motion sickness is all about. Now, the big difference in getting sick in space and getting sick on the ground, you get sick on the ground, whether you're on the ocean or whatever, at the surface of the Earth anyway, you get sick in an airplane or wherever else. You've got gravity acting on you. So you grab a bag and you barf into the bag, and everything is, may not be comfortable, but, you know, it's well-behaved. You get into space, now there's no gravity there pulling on things, and, you know, I have to be careful. I'm using that term loosely. Let me say you're weightless. You're floating. Everything is floating. Now you barf, and it doesn't go down into a bag. There is no down, you know? So you're playing a game here with, you know, the result of barfing floating around just like everything else is floating around, which I think people can visualize. But now visualize yourself in a spacesuit in weightlessness. And if you barf then, you can't get a bag. You can't even get your hands up to your mouth. Your hand is at the end of a sleeve. You may be able to touch your face plate, you know, outside, but you can't get to your mouth. And that stuff is pretty sticky. And so there's a kind of loose equation. It may not be absolute 100%, but basically if you're in a spacesuit in space, you barf, you die. because it's sticky and you're going to drown, or at least the possibility of you not being able to breathe is there. So it is not something you mess with. And that was the big challenge on Apollo 9 when on the third day of the mission, I was not going to be going outside. This was the testing all the different systems of the lunar module. But nevertheless, I barfed twice that day. And we didn't know what was going to happen on the next day or whether I was going to get over it. I mean, nobody knew anything. All we knew was that this was happening to me. And the next day, I was supposed to go outside on an EVA. And the afternoon of that third day, after the second time I barked, which was a real surprise, first time was sort of, I wouldn't say expected, but it was understandable. The second time was a bit of a shock, but that's a different issue. But in any event, Dave, the point was at the end of that third day of the mission, you know, we were all looking at each other and saying, man, we don't know what's going to happen here. That EVA, you know, we're not going to end up killing me just to try and get the EVA in. So we canceled the EVA at the end of the second day. And, you know, if worse came to worse and I didn't get any better, there was a possibility we were going to have to cancel the whole mission, not be able to do the rendezvous. And lo and behold, we might not meet that Kennedy goal of getting a human being to the moon and back safely by the end of the decade. I mean, this was March, and we didn't, there was not a lot of confidence we were going to be able to get the job done anyway, even if everything went well. So, you know, the end of that third day, pretty tough to go to sleep when, you know, yours truly had barked a couple of times and we canceled the EVA, and we might even have to cancel the whole mission. Pretty tough time, I'll tell you.
Wow. Well, you do get better. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to astronaut Rusty Schweikert, the lunar module pilot for Apollo 9 in March of 1969. You do get better. And let's talk about one of the opposite of that, a really wonderful experience you had, where you do get to go outside on an EVA. And so is Dave Scott. You guys are both, you're both outside. He's outside the command module. You're outside on the porch of the lunar module, I believe. And something happens where he has to change cameras or something like that. So you get this unprecedented thing that nobody ever gets to experience, where you just got to hang out in space with really nothing to do but take it all in for a few minutes. Could you tell us about that powerful experience you had?
Yeah, well, the big deal was that the next day, we during the EVA, we had already canceled, so we got up a little bit late. And the deal was that we were going to go through all of the procedures as if I was going to go outside to make sure everything, all the procedures were proper. And then, in a sense, simulate that I went outside, not really do it, and then pick up the procedures again as if I had just come in, and again, make sure that the recovery procedures, the post-EVA procedures, were all correct and check all that out. But as we got up to that, to simulating depressing the lunar module and me going outside, Jim and I both noticed, and I won't, elaborate on it, but Jim and I both noticed that, it looks as though on this day four, I'm past the point where I was, getting motion sick. And so as we came up on the point, where we were just going to simulate going out, Jim and I looked and said, hey, this looks okay. And Jim asked me if I thought it was a go, and I looked at him and said, yeah, I think it's a go. And he said, let's do it. And we did. So you're right. I was outside. I mean, and this was not expected at all. We expected I wouldn't be going out, in fact. But there I was outside going ahead with the EVA. And the task at the moment was to transfer up the front of the lunar module on a handrail and across the top of the lunar module and over to the command module. Dave was standing connected with an umbilical to the command module, and he was supposed to take a movie of this. And of course, we didn't have video in those days. This was going to be film, right? So he had a Mauer movie camera, wonderful German movie camera, that we used many times in space up until then. And Dave was taking pictures of me going up the front of the lunar module, hand over hand on the handrail, and then suddenly said, "Oh, hey, Jim, the movie camera just jammed. Let me try to get it working." And Jim said, "Okay, Dave, you got 5 minutes to get it working. We're tight on schedule here. Take 5 minutes to try to get it working. Rusty, just stay right there." Right. You betcha. So I just, I knew, I didn't know how long it would take Dave to get it fixed, and he never did get it fixed. We never got any more movies. I think he had a total on Apollo 9 of about a second and a half of my EVA on film. But Dave took the 5 minutes to try and get it working, and I said to myself, I don't know what Jim was doing inside the lunar module, but for those 5 minutes, but I said to myself, "Hey, this is, I'm not going to think about what I got to do next if Dave gets a camera working. I know what that is. I'm just going to really take advantage of whatever time it takes and really appreciate where I am. Just look at and let where I am penetrate this spacesuit. I'm not an astronaut. I'm a person. I'm a human being here in orbit around this beautiful Earth, and I'm going to let that sink in." And I just let go of the handrail with my right hand, swung out, holding on loosely with my left. There's no problem. You're just floating. You're not going to drift away or anything. I was just hanging on lightly, and I just sort of swung around 90 degrees and just hung there suspended, looking at this incredibly beautiful Earth out across the two vehicles at the horizon, coming up across the Pacific Ocean toward the west coast of the U.S. I mean, it was just incredibly beautiful, and I just let all that come in. So that was a very personal and frankly powerful experience, because unasked. I mean, I was just going to be a sponge. But unasked, as I did that, as I just hung there, it was like the magnitude of what was really going on came through. Not that I was there on Apollo 9 in a spacesuit and an A7L suit, blah, blah, blah. But that here I was, a human being, and we, as humans, in combination with our machines, were moving out from planet Earth, the only place that we know in the universe that has life. We probably think there's other life, maybe, but here we are moving out from the Earth at this moment in history, and who am I to be experiencing this? What's going on here? How did I get here? What do I mean when I say I? Is this me that's having this experience? No. This is humanity. I'm just a representative. I have an obligation. This is a moment that I need to fully experience and absorb and bring back to people on Earth who sent me, to life on Earth for that matter. This turned into a much bigger experience because of that crazy happening of the failure of a German movie camera. I mean, what you do during failures in your life is perhaps more important than what you do when things work right.
Well, that was a fortuitous failure for your experience and for you to share that with everyone throughout your life. I know you being able to share that experience,
especially coming after the real bummer, the lifetime record bummer of my life, the night before when we had canceled the EVA and we're thinking about canceling the whole mission. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, wow, Look at that. So you never know. I mean, that's the exciting thing about life, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's just a wonderful story. Rusty, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, I have a couple of quick questions for you, and one of them is going to be impossible to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You were played on the HBO miniseries by an actor named Kieran Mulroney, I believe his name is, who went on to be a screenwriter for the Sherlock Holmes movie Game of Shadows. And I was just wondering, what was it like for you to, you know, being a real person, looking at an actor playing you, having that experience? What was that like to experience that from your end?
Dave, you're right. It's impossible for me to answer because I can't even remember that. I remember, of course, that there was From the Earth to the Moon. I assume you're talking about the Apollo 9 sequence in From the Earth to the Moon. But, I hardly remember it, to be honest with you. It was certainly no big deal, I hate to say. You might want to ask another question.
Okay. Well, no, that's a perfectly honest answer. It's probably kind of a cool answer, really. It's like, instead of, yeah, no big deal, I didn't pay any attention. Instead of, oh, well, he didn't do as good a job of playing me as I would have. I think you come off well there, Rusty. Okay, now here's the really hard question. Could you just comment, the big picture of this is your mission is part of this much bigger picture of the Apollo program of going to the moon and coming back, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of all these flights here the next couple of years, ending with the 1972 mission would be the last trip to the moon. Can you tell us, what is the legacy, looking back at 50 years ago, what is the legacy of Apollo?
Yeah, that kind of question is really, kind of in my wheelhouse, and not in the sense that I have any particular great brilliance about responding to it, but it's in my wheelhouse of interest. I tend to be philosophical, and I'm also very interested in things like cosmology and philosophy. So you're throwing one right down the plate for me, but I tend to see this as an evolutionary step where, we're the only life we know of in this corner of the universe on this incredibly beautiful and somewhat fragile planet that we not only live on and depend upon, but we are beginning to understand that we have some responsibility for. And so my vision of this is that, we are collectively the evolutionary experiment in life that's going on in this corner of the universe. And we're not just a puppet with strings being pulled. We are actors. We are agents in how this evolutionary experiment really that we're living is going to grow, is going to develop, is going to evolve. We are actors in it. We are active participants. And so I see us having a very large responsibility here and a tremendous exciting opportunity and responsibility, frankly, as we move outward from planet Earth. Number one, we have to prevent the kind of catastrophe that can eliminate this, terminate this experience. Whether that's self-induced or whether it's induced by an asteroid impact or whatever, we need to use our technology and our brains and our capabilities to protect life on this planet so that this evolutionary process can go forward. And at some point, we can begin to diversify the location of life, of Earth life, out further into the cosmos. As Elon Musk refers to it, we need to become and think about ourselves becoming a multi-planetary species. Well, that's in my vision of it, where we're headed if we do a good job. And so I see the whole Apollo program as that first step out the birth canal of Mother Earth, moving out into the larger universe. And it's an incredibly exciting metaphor of where we are here. And Apollo was, especially Apollo 8, being that first opportunity for firsthand consciousness looking back at the Earth from that black and white, desolate moonscape. And there over the horizon came this incredibly beautiful Earth. And, of course, on Apollo 9 and then subsequent missions, you know, we're all part of this process. And it's not just the astronauts. It's all of us. We're all a part of this huge cosmic experiment in life, moving out from our birth mother. So that to me is what it's all about.
That's beautiful. And Rusty, I want to thank you so much for spending a generous amount of your time with us today. And I hope you totally enjoy that your get together with your crewmates and everybody in San Diego in March on the 13th.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly look forward to it. And, you know, it's been a great privilege, not just speaking with you and with everybody who has a chance to listen to the podcast, but being part of the Apollo program. It's just been a great, wonderful accident for a farm boy from New Jersey. And I've really appreciated it.
10 years ago, when Blue Dot was just a four-minute program then called the Blue Dot Report, I got to play in an unusual golf tournament in San Diego. It was the Moonwalker Invitational, and it featured many of the Apollo astronauts, including the late Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon when he commanded the Apollo 17 mission in December 1972. My playing partner was not one of the Moonwalkers, but he certainly was an all-star member of the Astronaut Corps. Jim McDivitt commanded the Gemini 4 mission that featured the first American EVA, or spacewalk, with Ed White in June of 1965. Then he commanded Apollo 9 in March of 1969. We spoke on the phone earlier this year, and Jim declined to join us to celebrate the Apollo 9 mission, which is understandable for anyone in their 90s that has a busy schedule. But playing golf with McDivitt and Cernan that day was an experience I'll never forget. They even gave me a lift back to my hotel, which was pretty cool too. Hey, thanks again to our guest, Jim's lunar module pilot on Apollo 9, Rusty Schweikert, who likes to play golf too, so I may see if I can hook up a game with him someday. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can hear this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. We're engineered and produced by Mr. Blue himself, Sky Schofield. And our associate producer, who has a dog named Rocket, is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.